Grüß Gott, meine Damen und Herren. Oh, hang on a minute. What language are we doing this podcast in?
Welsh.
Welsh. My Welsh isn't that so much up to scratch. Yeah, it's a shame Andrew isn't here. Maybe he could help us out.
I'm sure he knows some Welsh.
He knows lots of things about lots of things indeed. But yes, Andrew is basking in the sun somewhere at the moment, I believe. So, yeah, it's up to us to make this podcast.
It's a beautiful day here in the sunny southwest of England.
Really? Yeah. And I guess it's similar for you there, Ben, in Bristol.
Yeah, we've got blue skies here.
Oh, it's grey here and it sucks in upper Bristol area.
A little bugbear, because Andrew can't stop us waffling on now, is that I hate it when the news reports that today has been the hottest day of the year so far, especially when we're moving from winter through spring to summer. It's like, well, yes, every day is going to get progressively warmer. This is news.
Yep. Let it flow, Graham, let it flow.
That's like the one good bit on the news, though. It's, these people have died, the government's stealing all the freedoms, everything's going to rack and ruin, but at least it's hot.
True, we've got to stay positive. And on that...
Yeah, sorry.
On that positive note, we begin Season 3, Episode 10 of the Linux Voice podcast. I'm Mike Saunders.
I'm Ben Everard.
And I'm Graham Morrison.
Superb. In this podcast, we've got an interesting mixture in news. We have our finds of the fortnight and our fascinating voice of the masses. Everybody who's listening, I'm not going to be polite about it. Everybody who's listening to this should buy Linux Voice subscriptions. That's it.
Absolutely. Otherwise, we're going to have to find other jobs.
Yeah. And I don't have any other skills. So.
No. I can. Yeah, I used to wash dishes, so I could probably go back to that.
Oh, I used to wash dishes as well.
And I did as well. Should we start a restaurant, guys?
We just need some wait staff, cook, some bartenders, but we've got three dishwashers, so we're sorted.
Yeah, and some microwave-ready meals will do.
As we've all got it in our past, we could actually set up a consultancy business.
True.
I'm not sure I was ever that good at washing dishes.
That doesn't stop other people setting up consultancy businesses.
So, Ben, lead us into the news.
The news this fortnight, we have SourceForge has been continuing its shenanigans. This time, they've created a fake Nmap website with a fake download button that installs spyware. There is actually a real sort of download button for Nmap, but it's sort of hidden in the text further down below. So... the Nmap project is on SourceForge, but they didn't use all the SourceForge services, one of which is the website hosting. So the SourceForge team thought, well, we'll help them out here and create their website for them, obviously trying to do the right thing, no doubt. And accidentally copied and pasted in the wrong download button. I'm sure it's all an honest mistake.
It is very misleading, isn't it? This huge green button that says download now. Even as a total geek, I found it a bit hard to work out which one was correct.
They used to do this all the time when you went through to the download button. There was a massive button saying download, but that was an advert. Mm. And then there was a tiny little link. And then in 2013, I think it was, they pledged not to do this anymore.
Yeah.
And here we are again.
And here we are again, and we'll talk later more about SourceForge and adware and bundling with free software. But yeah, a lot of people are now looking to go to GitHub and other sites. But you know, who's to say the same things won't happen in the end? So these things need to make money somehow. They can't run off love and air forever. So
what I'm wondering is, obviously projects are going to move away from SourceForge, but since they're open source, there's nothing stopping SourceForge pulling in all their files from GitHub and still hosting all of them, even if they're not actually used for development.
True, if they wanted to be especially evil, yeah.
Well, they probably will, I imagine, because they're still like the top hit for many projects on Google.
Exactly. And
we got some clarification, didn't we, on hosting binary files on GitHub to say, I think, that it has been possible to host the binary files for some time.
That's it.
Yeah, I heard that as well. I still use SourceForge for hosting MicOS, but I don't use the download system. I simply have the MicOS zip file with the web files. So, yeah, I don't get all the fancy statistics and stuff like that, but it means people don't get redirected to these ridiculous download pages with a million different buttons.
Yeah. Isn't that what Nmap did? And that wasn't that the justification SourceForge used?
Oh, okay.
They said, oh, well, they weren't using the SourceForge download system, so we thought we'd help them out.
Now I really need to check what could be happening with my own admittedly tiny project.
Well, it's terrible. I just don't understand it. It's commercial suicide as well. I mean, if they're doing this for some very, very short-term gains in terms of advertising revenue, then, you know, their time is ultimately limited. I can't imagine them surviving another year.
But is this, I mean, is this going to be a open office, LibreOffice thing? Mm. Anyone in the loop is going to switch very quickly, but you know, all the people who don't keep up to date with tech news, but know that if you want to get the latest version of, I don't know, VLC.
That's right.
You go SourceForge.
I mean, this is before OpenOffice was relicensed to the Apache Foundation. Yes, many, many more people still downloaded OpenOffice.org under Oracle than did the completely free version and community-driven version of LibreOffice, which was kind of disappointing. But as you say, that's purely because it has so much kind of momentum and so much brand recognition and a much clearer name. But yeah, you're right. You're right.
They're still going to have all the sort of search engine rankings for stuff for a long time.
We've created a monster. Isn't it a bit like, maybe we're really talking too much, but the Internet Movie Database, as I remember that started off by being this fantastic community-driven project where thousands of people filled its database with their own research material, their own writings, and cross-linked everything in the same way that Wikipedia works. However, the Internet Movie Database wasn't Wikipedia, didn't have an open license, and was bought by a big company and turned into a commercial enterprise. It was about 10 years ago or 8 years ago, but I seem to remember a similar thing happening. And, you know, IMDb has since remained high, top on all Google rankings, but it doesn't have any of that community kind of ownership. Yeah,
I mean, maybe somebody can step in now and create an open source hosting provider with adverts or something, but they actually put in their agreement, you know, we will not bundle adware. Adverts are important for lots of websites to survive, but there's got to be a better way.
That's true. I mean, obviously GitHub doesn't bundle adware, but is there anything in its license that says it won't?
Don't know. I never read licenses.
Yeah,
who does? Yes.
All right, should we move on to the next item of news? We've dissected that one as far as it will go.
No, I'm thinking we can go further. But we won't have any listeners left.
So next up, Geggle, the generic graphics library that is, although being generic, is used almost exclusively by GIMP, has got its first update since it first came into GIMP. Which has got a whole host of improvements. It's quite a big update, really. It's got things like experimental support for threading, so potentially much better performance there. Loads of new filters, all the sort of good graphics-y stuff that I don't know how to use.
It brings in 71 new image processing operations. So a lot of these are like GIMP filters that have been redone for Geggle. A lot of it is stuff that's over my head as well. I don't use graphics editors that much, but all of this stuff should find its way into GIMP 2.10, which will be a pretty major release. People are going to argue forever about GIMP's interface and stuff, but it will bring it a lot more on a par with Photoshop and the like.
Well, it's got the switched option for the interface now, so you can have it in the three windows or the one window.
Yeah, but that's true.
It's still a bit...
I don't have a huge problem with GIMP's user interface. But it's very dated. The whole thing could do with they just need more developers, and they need people donating money to them,
like we did.
So yeah, it's exciting times for the project at the moment. But another software release this fortnight has been Cinnamon, which comes out to version 2.6, This is a desktop interface built on GTK3, used mostly by Mint, but used by a few others now as well. Mm. I think you've been using this one, Mike.
I have. I had a quick look at it about a week or two ago, and I thought, oh, we'll review it for the magazine. And then found out there's actually a lot of new stuff in there. So, yeah, the full review will be in Linux Voice 17, which will be sent out in a week or two. Yeah, Cinnamon started off as a fork of GNOME 3, because the Mint team, Linux Mint distro team, wanted to use the same desktop technology and all the new updates, but without the very sort of modern tablet-y interface. So they wanted a more traditional design. In Cinnamon 2.6, they've got a better system setting dialogues, proper screensaver support. Previously, you just had a blank screen, but now it can use X screensaver screen savers. New plugin manager and the file manager. Optimizations for the window manager, so it's about 40% faster. They've got the first proper API documentation. It can use both ConsoleKit and LoginD, so systemd haters can still use traditional init systems with it. And yeah, it's even got this control alt esc key cords that lets you restart the desktop without logging out. So if you come across some bug or something freezes up, you can restart the desktop while your apps keep running. I mean, on the whole, it's becoming a really good all-round desktop and not just a tweaked GNOME 3 like it was at the start. It's really getting well fleshed out now, and I really recommend it.
Well, I haven't used it in quite a long time, actually, because I found it didn't offer that much over Mate, and yep, it ran quite a lot slower. But it sounds like that might be changing now.
Yeah, they're working on speed ups and performance tweaks. And like you say, it's pretty much still associated with the Linux Mint distribution, but you can get it for Fedora, and maybe as time goes on it will become available in other distros package repositories.
Right, next up, surprisingly we have some Apple related news this fortnight. It's been a while since we've had that.
In a positive or negative way?
Well, it's probably positive, but I'm going to present it in a cynical way.
Oh, that's not like you.
The world's biggest company, probably, I haven't checked that's still true, is to release Swift under an OSI license. Swift is their programming language they developed as a successor to Objective-C, I don't know, about a year ago.
I think it was, yeah. It's become massively popular by all the cool little app developing kiddies.
Because you had to use it to write iOS.
Yeah,
pretty much. But I think this is interesting news rather than important news, because for a few reasons, I think this is something isn't something Apple want to do. I think it's something they feel they've been forced to do. And that's a bit unusual for Apple, because for so long they dictated the way they want to run their business, and I think this is different. I think this is something they've had to do to stay relevant. And obviously it follows on the open sourcing of .NET from Microsoft, about a month or two ago. And it just shows that the power that developers as a group have, you have to court them onto your platform, and they're asking for open source. Developers want open source, otherwise they won't work with you.
Well, and presumably it has the advantage that if it's open source and builds on Linux, then people will dabble around with Swift, can try Swift out, try it out on Linux before then they go and buy their fancy expensive Mac and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, obviously a lot of the back end to apps run on Linux. If you're almost all mobile apps are sort of client server type things. So if you're developing like that, it means you only have to know one language rather than two.
I think it's a really brilliant point that you've made, actually, Ben. And I think it maybe marks a change in Apple's strategy. It wasn't so long ago, maybe 5 years ago, that they seemed to be trying to remove open source from their operating system, despite it being a foundation of its success. I remember them saying they wanted to remove the file sharing elements based on Samba and move them to their own proprietary protocols, so that they didn't have this reliance, even though they never said it publicly, but you just got a feeling that they didn't like the stench of open source. That's how it felt that Apple was going. And Swift has become at least in the kind of geekier programming community, a lot of people like Swift, and a lot of people are refusing to look at Swift until it's kind of its future is enshrined within an open source license. And I think that's, and Apple, even in its slide and its keynotes, mentioned Linux. You know, Linux was on there or being shown to the audience. And I, and that's the first time I can think of that ever happening. And I think you made really, really important point. They're not doing this because they want to. They're doing it because they have to, or to ensure its kind of future viability.
Yeah, maybe it's a bit like when Microsoft announced Linux on their Azure virtual machines. You know, I can imagine they weren't particularly enthusiastic about it, but what are people running in the cloud? Massively, Linux.
Yeah. I hope it, I just hope it, hope it leads to more things like that.
It's unlikely. Has anyone tried programming in Swift yet?
They haven't actually released it yet.
No.
Okay.
I did try Objective-C once, but I just couldn't get my head around it as a C++ programmer. It just had very little to do with C. I don't know. I remember Paul Hudson's old, massively committed to it, and he's actually got a site and some tutorials on running Swift and developing Swift. Shout out to Paul Hudson.
I always assumed Objective-C was basically C++, but just different enough that you couldn't compile one on the other.
No, I don't know. It wasn't when I looked at it. It's like a...
Okay. It's sort of, you have a sort of list of languages you're going to look at. I've got Rust and Go on my list of languages ahead of Swift.
And if you follow the Hacker News front page, by the time you've learned a bit of Go, you think, oh, it's so passe, and all the cool kids are talking about this new language or framework. And
well, I interviewed Rob Pike, one of the he's got a long history in computing, but also he created the Go language a few years ago and did a tutorial in the old mag about Go, and I loved it then. It was brilliant, simple, you know, and the fact that it's gone on to be so fundamental in so many ways, on especially with Google's web stack, but lots of other things besides. It is a cool little language that's now become complex. I mean, I'd need to look really into it now.
So on to our final item of news for the fortnight that has absolutely nothing to do with open source or Linux, but I just found it so interesting I'm putting it in. A Spanish military plane has crashed, and it's suspected, although not completely confirmed, that the cause of this is that someone accidentally deleted a config file. And without the config file, the fly-by-wire system misinterpreted the engine readings, span the propeller too slowly, and it couldn't stay in the air and crashed, killing four people.
Hmm. Ouch.
I mean, it was only a couple of weeks ago, wasn't somebody arrested for hacking into the flight control system through the in-flight entertainment system?
Wow, was it ever actually confirmed they did anything other than tweet about it?
I don't know. There were two different stories. There was the guy that was tweeted about it and arrested, and I think there was a different story about somebody who supposedly did it while on the flight. But yes, they're probably in Guantanamo now. Both of them. Or three of them.
Do you know what operating system this plane was running, Ben? I'm assuming some sort of embedded thing like VxWorks. Or...
Yeah, I'm sure it's some proprietary embedded thing. It hasn't come out.
So probably when you deleted the configuration file, it created its own configuration with a load of useless defaults.
Yeah.
I shouldn't be laughing, actually. There was another story that's actually loosely related to Spain, in that BQ, the people who made the original Ubuntu phone, have updated it. They've created a new 5-inch version, which I think is called the Aquarius E5 HD, which is €200. So there's two Ubuntu phones out you can officially buy in the European markets.
Wow.
Do you still use yours at all?
I do use it, yes. I install the updates and try and see what's changed, but it's not the phone I put in my pocket when I leave the house. There are just too many things I rely on in Android. In fact, one of the things I'm looking into doing is dual booting Ubuntu phone with Android to see if it's feasible. I know you can do it from like a Nexus 4 with Android installed, but I don't know if you can do it from the Aquarius and put in Android alongside it, because that would kind of solve the problem. I still, you know, think it's brilliant what Canonical and Ubuntu are trying to do. I really want it to succeed, but yes, it's so difficult when there's so much that I rely upon in Android.
And that's the news this fortnight.
I think that means it's your favourite section then, Graham.
Oh, yes, it is. I haven't said that for quite a long time. It is my favourite section. It's Finds of the Fortnight, or Discoveries, as we used to call it.
Did you ask the IRC channel?
I did. I asked. I didn't give them much advance notice, but having said that, I do it before news, so it's about half an hour of advance notice. there's been a few responses. I'm just looking at the screen now. Still Void is always reliable for finds. I don't know what he does every 2 weeks, but it's a hell of a lot, and he seems to discover loads of things. My main find of recent weeks is that Docker-compose is the bee's knees. You can use it to easily run a whole stack of related services in Docker and connect them together easily, which is great for development and local testing. Another find that came out of playing with Docker-compose is that YAML is wonderful.
Markup language, yeah.
Yeah. And I'm officially out of love with JSON, J-S-O-N. Also, I wrote a thing because I couldn't find a thing, something I needed. So he's written something called, on some GitHub, stillvoid/please. It's a command line tool for working with web services, makes HTTP requests and passes the responses. And he says, finishes up with, and go is lovely. So that's about five finds from Stillvoid.
Does he say what he doesn't like about JSON?
No, he doesn't. He just says he's out of love with JSON. So, yes.
I quite like JSON.
It is good. I mean, I don't spend too much time programming with JavaScript, but when I need to do something quickly, JSON just seems to be the quickest way of doing things.
It works really well with Python as well. And it's always that thing where you've got to use either JSON or XML. And it's like, oh, I don't want to use XML. Yeah, and I think it seems nice in comparison.
There's so much more thinking involved. Well, XML is just fake, isn't it? It's useful. Obviously, it's fundamental to the way that text is organized, but it doesn't do anything.
Should also note, while Graham's looking at this, that the IRC channel we're talking about is hash Linux voice on chat.freenode.net. So listeners should come and join us. I think there's normally about 70 or so people active in the channel.
Yes, at the moment there's 68 people. That's it, mostly Stillvoid. There was a good conversation then after Stillvoid's finds, and in particular his, I think his HTTP requesting command, and somebody talking about how useful it might be for grabbing weather requests and stuff like that. And Devilment mentions that today is the start of the Steam summer sale, which if into gaming is usually a big thing because Steam, the online games platform, does huge, huge discounts. So you often get like AAA titles for less than a fiver if you're into that kind of thing.
Wow.
Any other finds?
I've had a couple emailed to me, so I haven't had to do any work again in the last 2 weeks. Stephanie Jim let me know about the Lemon Pi. This is a crowdfunded Raspberry Pi-like single board computer. $35. It's going to be quad-core, 2 gigahertz chip, 1 gig of RAM, HDMI out, 3 USB ports, SD card slot, 40-pin Raspberry Pi compatible header. They're doing this on crowdfunding. They need $10,000, and so far they've raised $2,500 with 38 days left. And it all seems to be based in Shenzhen.
$10,000?
Yeah, doesn't seem like. But the thing is, it could be all right, but it doesn't seem to offer anything that the Raspberry Pi doesn't offer. The Raspberry Pi has a massive supporting community, and there are so many of these boards out there that seem to just be carbon copy clones. And if they could do something innovative and different.
And also the thing with them supporting, I mean, the Raspberry Pi Foundation makes devices for as cheap as they can possibly make it. But, you know, through selling 5 million devices, they've made money. And the great thing about it is that it's a charity, and that money that they make goes back into supporting the causes that led them to create the Raspberry Pi in the first place.
Yeah.
So I'm always kind of dubious about supporting or advertising. And not that it's wrong to. I just mean, would I spend money on a Lemon Pi? Probably not. I like supporting the Raspberry Pi Foundation. However, as you say, if something ultra powerful and small and cheap comes along, I'd go for it.
Yeah, it's when you look at the amount of support, the amount of engineering time the Raspberry Pi Foundation have put into a lot of open source projects, it's huge.
Yeah, they don't do enough to actually publicise it. Things like Wayland, they're almost the biggest committer, I think, to Wayland, or one of them.
Yeah, and a lot of the browser rendering engines, they've put quite a bit of work into, I think, as well. And
yeah, that's, I guess, because Eben told us, didn't he, Ben, that when it's remarkable, all the code is there because it's there for like WebKit running on Android, except for a lot of it doesn't work if you're using it in a different environment, and it just means going through all that and enabling it, which helps all of us.
Yeah, and building a lot of ARM optimizations in, because previously so many of these manufacturers just do it on razor thin margins that they can't afford to sort of optimize anything. If it runs, great. If not, it's cheaper to put a faster chip in than actually work on the code.
Yeah.
But they've done great work in doing ARM optimizations for just about every bit of major Linux software.
I think the proof is in Kodi. Sorry, Mike. Proof is in Kodi. You know, Kodi needs a really great PC to run it normally, but it runs brilliantly on a Raspberry Pi and ultra brilliantly on a Raspberry Pi 2. That's it. Sorry, Mike.
That's all right. The other find that was emailed to me is from Bruce Wolf, who says, if, like me, you use a Logitech wireless keyboard and or mouse, and there's a good chance it connects to your computer with a unifying receiver. These receivers not only allow you to use the device, but let you configure it. As is typical, Logitech only provides clients for the big two commercial operating systems. And last time I looked, there was nothing available for Linux. Having just upgraded one of my machines to Fedora 22, I had a stroll through Fedora's repositories and found Solar. That's like Solar with two A's, if we can link to it in the notes. It says, pleasant surprise. Solar appears to provide most of the functionality needed, although reprogramming custom keys is still in development. There are packages for most of the other major Linux distros and support for the Nano receiver, which is another Logitech wireless receiver. Thanks, Bruce. I don't use any wireless kit, but hopefully that will be useful to somebody.
My wireless mouse, my keyboard's wired. Just has a little USB WhatsApp that plugs in and works.
Yeah, I've got two Logitech mouse and keyboards here, and they're both wireless, and they both have their own. I've never felt the need to have any kind of finer control over them, but that's still, I still have to check it out. The keyboard layout is always a bit tricky to sort out on my keyboard in particular, but yeah, they sound like great finds.
Yeah, thanks everyone who emailed me.
I've got a really geeky audio one. I've not had that for a while. In the process of writing FOSPIX, and I didn't put it in FOSPIX because there hasn't been an update to the Linux version for a couple of years, but I'd never come across this before. It's called DIN is Noise, which is a recursive acronym. So it's a commercial sound generator software synthesizer for OS X and Windows, but it's open source, or it was open source until like 18 months ago. So you can build it and compile it on Linux, and the guy that develops it builds binaries, and you can install it through most package managers and play with it. I think he tries to make his living out of it, and for whatever reason, it's stopped porting the source over to from the latest commercial versions. But either way, the last version that he released with the source code is really magnificent. If you're into creating parabolic drone sounds out of saw or triangle or sine waves, because that's what it does.
Oh, yes, I always create drone sounds out of parabolic saw and sine.
It's every Sunday afternoon for me.
So yeah. the great thing about this is that you basically draw a waveform or a path using like Bezier curves, and then you put sound generators on these Bezier curves, and they move along them, and they generate pitches and tones that move and shift according to how you manipulate them on the screen. And so you can create lots of really interesting drones that go on for 2 hours or 48 hours or whatever your art installation requires.
Are you the reincarnation of John Cage?
You have to hear it. I haven't got a sample to play you, but wow. It sounds amazing.
When you say drone,
Yeah.
What does that mean?
Drone. Well, there's a whole genre of music that's drone music, and basically,
what drones listen to.
It's if you know this, you know the sound of a drone, like a helicopter drone.
Yeah,
it's a bit like that. This program is like, you could have 8 or 12 of those flying out. It's the sound of 8 or 12 of them flying outside your window. and moving away from you, moving closer to you, different kinds of Doppler shift and pitches and all that kind of... That is... I mean, I've used a modern term for drone, but drone has been around for ages, and it is basically this long, monotonous tone that changes in very subtle ways over time.
That sounds terrible. It's a form of music that sounds like a helicopter.
Yeah.
Lots of helicopters.
Hey, don't diss it until you've tried it. It's
okay.
We have sort of a bit of wasteland near our house, and the police are always searching for people in that. I get to hear it most nights. I don't enjoy it.
But, well, okay, it doesn't have to sound like a helicopter. That's at its most extreme. It can be just like sine waves or a pleasant kind of filtered triangle wave. You know, it can sound relaxing. That's my find.
My find it's a website. It's data.gov.uk/apps. And this is a list of sort of, they call them apps, but most of them are sort of websites or phone thingies that are built using the government's open data. And there's all sorts of them. There's one that sort of correlates weather forecasts with astronomical events. So you can see not just what's going on at night, but whether or not you'll be able to see it or where can see it and that sort of thing. There's ones that sort of pull in all the NHS data to tell you which are good places to go when you're sick. There's
Get like extract the data in like YAML and other great formats.
Yeah, I mean, this is all built on the data that government's released, so it's mostly available in CSV or PDF.
And okay.
Whoever thought it was a good idea to release it in PDF, I've no idea. but yeah, most of it's available in CSV, which you can do stuff with if you work hard.
And are they open source?
Not all of them. But some of them, obviously the data is all open, so you can go and recreate them fairly easily if you wish. There's one that if you put in a destination and sort of where you are, it sort of calculates the driving route, but it'll show you which places have the most accidents along that route, so you can see how safe it is.
Or you can take the most dangerous route and run the gauntlet. Feel a sense of satisfaction when you arrive alive.
Yeah, there's... Let's have a look at some more. There's one that will tell you when your MOT is due.
That's handy, actually.
There's one, actually, I don't think it's on there, but it's done by The Guardian using the open data. It has a map of all the restaurants in the country, and they're colour-coded by how well they've done on their food hygiene rating. And I discovered that the chippy I go to got a 1 out of 5 food hygiene. And I think you get shut down if you get a 0.
Have you had chips from there?
Not since then. but to be honest, I don't think it would put me off. So yeah, there's loads of stuff on there.
That sounds good. It sounds like despite all the problems with the government, there's some things that are making progress, accessibility to data and documentation and open source, open standards.
Yeah, I mean, the last coalition government did do quite a lot of good stuff on open source and open access.
Cory Doctorow talks a little bit like this about this subject in the next issue of Linux Voice.
Issue 17, yep.
Which is out in a couple of weeks.
It should be out in a couple of weeks, yeah. And, of course, it will be on our shop. May as well mention that we have some T-shirts available on our shop. Not many left now. Those of you who met us at OggCamp will remember us wearing them, and quite a few people bought them back then.
We've also sold out of issue one. We were always going to do like a bit of a fanfare about this because it seemed kind of significant. But I, you know, I cleared out the garage a couple of weeks ago and realized that we only had two copies left. And it was like, quick, Mike.
Yeah.
I think you mean our warehouse, Graham.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah.
Our logistics division.
Yeah. The Wiltshire Distribution Centre. Depot.
The Wiltshire Depot was running out of space for the bike.
For the beer.
Yeah.
Yeah, so issue ones are now extremely rare items. And if you have one, then you should get it sealed and stamped like an Action Comics edition, whatever Superman appeared or whatever. On that note, this brings us to the 76% point of the podcast, still to come, the voice of the masses. Was there anything else Andrew would normally say at this point? Maybe some Smiths reference or...
Yeah, he always says it somewhat reluctantly, but I think you've pulled that off, actually.
Okay, so let's cruise headfirst into the voice of the masses, which in this episode goes back to what we were talking about with SourceForge and bundling adware with other people's software. And we put forward the question, should free and open source software licenses be modified to prevent this sort of thing from happening? As in, should we add clauses to them to say they make it impossible for people to ship adware alongside Foster? That's obviously quite a complicated thing to do. The general impression from our listeners is no, because while the idea is not so bad itself, it goes against the spirit of freedom. Dan the Electronic Penguin, for instance, says FOSS licenses should learn from Creative Commons and be flexible, offering the option but leaving the decision to the developer. Espada V8 says no, they shouldn't. That would go completely against the spirit of most or all FOSS licenses by removing freedoms. If the maintainer wants to bundle adware with their software, that's their choice. But if the software is popular enough, there will very quickly be other people that recompile the source into a package that doesn't include the adware, or simply fork the project. What do you guys think?
I think we don't need to tackle this with licenses. I think trademark is the way to do it. And it's things like with Firefox, you can modify the source of Firefox all you like. You can put adware in there if you want, but you can't call the resulting package Firefox and you have to remove all branding from it. So it can still be under an open license, but you've still got legal recourse to stop people abusing it in that way. And actually, I noticed, I didn't mention this in the news deliberately because I wanted to bring it up here, but the fake Nmap page uses trademarked logos and whatnot, and Nmap have obviously asked them to stop using that. As yet, I believe they haven't. But this does give them a legal recourse to come back and say, actually, that's, you know, you can use the code, you can put adverts in the code if you want, but you cannot call it Nmap. You cannot create websites using our license, using our logo and all that sort of thing. And I think that's a proper way of fighting it rather than putting new clauses in licenses.
It's a great idea, and it works for big projects like Firefox and Nmap, but what about smaller projects? Like if I created a project called K-Album, I mean, I'd have to go jump through extra hoops to trademark that.
No, but don't you automatically get trademark?
I don't think so.
I thought you automatically had trademark rights for creating something.
No, it's copyright.
You automatically get copyright, and you don't have to license the logo, for example, under the same terms.
But you have to register a trademark.
You do have to register a trademark. But if you didn't release the artwork under the GPL or whatever license you use for the rest of it, you'd still have a copyright claim on that. And you could release the artwork under a license that said, this is only to be used with official binaries.
I think a better solution is to start a service that... sets off with a user agreement that enshrines the rights of the project on the site. I think this is just going to keep happening, probably, you know, in 10 years' time or 15 years' time, and GitHub is no longer run by its founders. It might happen again. And so if it's obvious that we need some way of hosting stuff like this, there needs to be some kind of longevity in projects that last 10 or 15 years. And that's the way that I'd say it needs to be solved. in a Wikipedia or an internet archive for projects that enshrines the rights of the projects within its terms of service.
Right, you know when you click on a website, they say you're uploading something to GitHub, you have to say that if by clicking here I agree to the terms and service, blah, 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 blah. If I put something in my upload to GitHub saying, by accepting this pull request, you're accepting these terms of service, we will not re-license your code, we will not put adverts in your code. Do you reckon that would be legally binding?
I don't know. Didn't you say that Cory Doctorow had like a disclaimer in his email response that said, but in responding to, was it Cory? In responding to this email, you are accepting I have complete rights to do whatever I want to and deny all of your other rights or prior to all that kind of
thing. There was. Hang on. Where's my email?
Who's got a ticking clock?
Oh, that might be me.
It's quite nice. You need a grandfather clock.
Let's have a look. There's a few things in there. It's got, for public safety reasons, this email has been intercepted by your government and will be retained for future analysis. I assume he put that into his email.
He might not have put that in, yeah.
Yeah. It says, read carefully. By reading this email, you agree on behalf of your employer to release me from all obligations and waivers arising from any and all non-negotiated agreement, licenses, terms of service, shrink wrap, click wrap, browse wrap, confidentiality, non-disclosure, non-compete, acceptable use policy, bogus agreements that I have entered into with your employer, its partners, licenses, agents, and assigns in perpetuity.
In perpetuity.
That's the one. Without prejudice to my ongoing rights and privileges, you further represent that you have the authority to release me from any bogus agreements on behalf of your employer.
That's brilliant. Is that Creative Commons? Can we use it?
Yeah, I'll ask. And it also goes on, as is the case with every email you've ever received, this email has not been scanned for all known viruses.
Yeah, something like that.
So let's see what some of the other readers said. David Filders said, I don't have a problem with anyone adding whatever they like to a download, providing they notify you what they are including so you can make an informed decision. People have got so used to free services that they rarely stop to think about the cost of the service. SourceForge is not free to provide and must be paid for somehow. I don't have a problem with how the owner of the service chooses to fund it as long as they're upfront about that. Unfortunately, few companies are willing to do that and hide behind user license agreements or similar. I think that's a fair point, but the problem with what SourceForge is doing is they're deliberately misleading people with big green download buttons that ostensibly are for the software in question. But
it's completely 100% unacceptable. It's almost criminal, I think.
Yeah, you've also got the situation that Oracle do with Java, where they do sort of tell you they're going to bundle a load of crapware in with it, but it's sort of behind about three screens where you have to click on advanced options, super advanced options, etc., etc. There's a check button in, and if you ever once forget to do it on any update ever, which it does every week, that's it, you're stuck with it for life.
Yeah.
So it does sort of tell you, but...
Yeah, they are giving you the option, but it's a lot of people will... I'm not even know that it's there. B3NDZ says, perhaps SourceForge should consider a small hosting fee, maybe a tiered structure like WordPress. I don't mind paying for an ad-free blog. I mean, that might be an idea for some of the bigger projects. You know, you pay and you get more features and more reliability or, you know, more bandwidth.
Yeah, I mean, he is right that these services do cost money, and it can cost quite a lot of money to run, and there has to be a way of recouping that. In GitHub's method is that you can pay to host private code on there.
Yep.
SourceForge is through adverts. And yeah, the correct solution isn't just to remove all ways of people making money and recouping their costs. And yeah, a paid service actually provided good options may well work.
It could be that SourceForge found that people were no longer using things like its subversion development tools and were just using it as a binary download repository. And so they could see that their days are numbered anyway. So they just thought that they'd inject this crap into their downloads. It's horrendous. It's completely unacceptable. It makes the open source community look like fools because, you know, it may be that downloading the GIMP or FileZilla from SourceForge is the first experience a Windows user has with open source. And they're just going to have, they're always going to have in the back of their mind, how does free software pay for itself? And the first thing they're going to see is that their search bar has been changed in Firefox or, and it's almost impossible to get rid of. And it's terrible.
I've got a controversial idea. Should Microsoft host it?
Ooh.
In the same way that Debian host all the Debs, Fedora host all their RPMs, etc. Should Microsoft step up and host the binary files do a really
good,
software?
Yeah, I think they do a really good job. I don't think they'd dare do anything. They do a really good job. Yeah, I think it's a good idea.
They certainly seem to be trying to curry favour with the open source community. But I think that is a very good point you've mentioned, Graham. That is the first experience people will get. We always struggle to explain to people the difference between free software and freeware, you know, the sort of adware-infested junk you get on Windows. Free software is a completely different world. But a lot of people will simply conflate the two after this. Yeah.
Yeah, because I think we live in a bubble, in a good bubble in Linux open source land. As soon as you start using OS X or Windows for anything and you need to download something to do a small tool that you don't even think about on Linux, you find that it's shareware or that it's proprietary or that it's ad-riddled. And it's I don't know how anyone puts up with it.
Oh, it's horrid installing free software on Windows. Yeah.
And on these app stores that are supposedly well maintained as well on Android and even on Apple's walled garden, there's so much crapware out there that claims to do something, wants to spy on your data, or just doesn't work. The best experience for software distribution is firing up Synaptic and
you're
installing
forced into their upgrades, and you're forced into whatever they remove features, you know, in an upgrade that you didn't have any control over and stuff like that, and you can't roll it back.
It's that thing that every once in a while I'll turn on my phone and there's a little blank square where there used to be an app in my launch and I have to try and work out who's deleted their app from me.
Yeah, so the end result is Linux wins, which is a nice note to end on. Thanks for all the feedback and ideas, everybody, for that section. And I guess that's it for a couple of weeks.
Yeah, so don't forget the issue 16 is out on sale at the moment. It's still got a couple of weeks to go.
Issue 16 with the big 59 distros feature on the front cover. And it's also got a newbie guide as well. We put a guide to converting newbies to Linux in there. Now, obviously, that won't be of use to a lot of hardcore Linux users who've been with us for a while, but the idea is you can cut it out. It's Creative Commons. You can photocopy it and give it to other Linux users to convert them. We were all newbies once. So, yeah, while Linux Voice is a very geeky magazine and always will be, we hope this guide will bring new sheep into the flock.
Yeah. Brilliant.
Superb stuff. Thanks, everybody, for your time and patience. And we'll see you in 2 weeks. Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye.
Bye.